These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
And welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 19th, 2018. As I mentioned last week, the interview portion of our show will be encore presentation. But before we get to them, I have a bit of housekeeping and commentary. Item one in housekeeping is the Outspoken Cyclist blog. Many of you download the show through your mobile app, or it's downloaded automatically each week. But believe it or not, there's also a weekly blog that accompanies each show. The blog contains links to a lot of what my guests and I discuss, and there is a comment section. So if you comment, I would be delighted to not only see them, but to respond to them. And they don't hurt our stats either. The second item is an event Brian and I are hosting for the FIDF, Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, here in Northeast Ohio. The ride is Sunday, June 24th, and we'll travel through several of our east side suburbs into the magnificent Cleveland Metro Parks, heading for a turnaround in Strongsville at Millstream Run. There are rest stops with great snacks every 12 miles or so, and the total distance is 75 miles. But since it is out and back, you can turn around at any time. The ride is to highlight the STRIDES program, the work that the FIDF does to get wounded soldiers back on their feet, literally and figuratively, with super high-tech prosthetic limbs. We rode with a bunch of these guys in Israel. They kicked our butts. If you're interested, log on to www.fidf.org/RideOhio and register. We would love to see you there. Now on to the commentary. Over the past 8 years, we've reported on cyclists being hit by cars way too often. In a recent interview with Russ Rader from the IIHS, Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, the actual statistics were mind-boggling. This past week has been even more depressing, although we are starting to see some prosecution and incarceration for perpetrators, but it barely scratches the surface. So why am I bringing this up again? Because I've been asked to convene a safety symposium to be held in conjunction with the North American Handmade Bike Show in Sacramento, March 15th of 2019, auspiciously the Ides of March. I'm looking for content, attendees who have a stake in finding some solutions, law enforcement, and the legal community. The goal of the symposium is to find some common ground and establish some basic rules that can not only be taught, but also be enforced, where everyone can agree that driving a car is a privilege and that abusing that privilege requires some sort of penalty. If you have a story or have been affected by an incident related to bicycle automobile safety, please contact me at outspokencyclist@gmail.com. I'm not just looking for horror stories. It would also be good to know some successes. So it's time to move on to this week's show. My conversations this week are both encore presentations. You also had input into this week's show by requesting specific people. And all of those who voiced an opinion, thank you. In fact, it's made me realize I need to get back to some people and catch up. So I have put together a couple of very eclectic people. I first met up with Grant Peterson, now of Rivendell, when he was the force behind Bridgestone's innovative designs back in the 80s and 90s. This conversation is from 2013, and his book, Just Ride, had just been published. Then we're going to go back to the second interview I had with iconic frame builder Richard Sachs. This conversation was about his thoughts on doping, and in that interview, which is from 2012, you'll hear Greg Priddy's voice as he chimes in with some interesting questions and commentary. So I hope you'll enjoy the show. Let's move on to my 2013 chat with Grant Peterson. So let's move on right now and talk to one of my favorite people. I think you're going to enjoy him, Grant Peterson. Grant, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Well, thanks, Diane.
I haven't talked to you in a long time.
It's been a while, yeah, maybe a year and a quarter.
At least. Actually, it's been longer than that. So
awesome.
I had several listeners who asked that I catch up with you and chat with you, and you have such a unique perspective on bicycles and cycling.
Do they want me to say controversial things?
Only if you want to, whatever you want to do. So
I don't want to, but we'll see where it all goes.
Okay, I'm going to begin with just a simple question. And you use the word velocity as opposed to philosophy. So what is your basic velocity about the bicycle, the actual machine?
Yeah, never really thought about it. No.
Yes, you have.
I know. Okay. Well, I think it's, you know, a bike should be a toy for fun or maybe a tool to make your life easier or, you know, maybe transportation to get somewhere, but I don't think of the bike as a workout device. Now, this sort of came to me late in life. I certainly did for most of my life, so I'm in rehab from that. But, you know, I think that thinking of the bike as a toy or a tool or transportation doesn't rule out vigorous rides that make you sweat and get you tired as long as they're fun. But it does rule out training if the purpose of training is just to, go out there to be able to train yourself in a shape that you can even ride more miles or the same miles even faster and do it again and keep ramping up. I don't think that kind of riding is fun for a lot of people, and I don't think it's healthy for anybody. So that's sort of my own take on the bike or velocity. And as I said, it's, you know, I came to it only maybe 8 to 10 years ago, and I'm 58 now, so there.
No.
I just want the bike. I want to like the bike. I don't want to be, you know, a slave to it. So,
how did you get to be 58?
Well, you have to talk to my parents. I'm afraid that's impossible right now.
I'm just busting your chops here a little. So let's talk about the bicycle. You still believe in steel.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the world, or a lot of the world, seems to be enamored with carbon fiber. Talk to me about that. Talk to me about where steel makes sense and where carbon fiber has sort of crept into the American consumer's psyche, that's what's being offered to them.
Well, yeah. I think people are used to buying performance just in general. You know, you can buy performance in electronics, for instance. You can buy, I don't know, I don't have a really good electronics vocabulary, but I think there are things called processors or something and some kind of electronic things, and you can buy them. And so when you push a button, something happens in fewer milliseconds, you know, than it did 2 months ago when the previous processor was in the widget. So I think people can buy performance in vehicles. If by performance, I think, you know, you mean speed, and in most cases that you know, vehicle performance, and a bike is a vehicle. Of course, it usually means speed, and people are used to buying that. You can buy a motorcycle or a rocket ship or a car with a bigger engine, and you can buy that speed. And because they're in the habits of buying speed in vehicles and speed in electronics, you know, they sort of take this whole I can buy speed, I can buy performance mentality to the bike shop when they go to buy a bike. And yet, going back to, you know, what performance is in a vehicle, you know, it's speed, and speed depends on the engine. And a bicycle, and I say this in my book, but a bicycle is the vehicle that you are the engine. The engine buys the vehicle. And so you can't really buy speed on a bike. You can buy something that is lighter weight, and you can say, well, if it's lighter, I'm going to be able to go faster on it. But that, you know, that is such a simplification of reality that, you know, it's hard to really just agree with that statement wholeheartedly. But performance in a bike, you know, to me is, I think it's better redefined as not speed, but capability. And that's where things kind of start to get fun. How capable is a racing bike, really, or any typical carbon road bike, if it doesn't fit a practical tire or doesn't fit a fender, if the gears are too high, the bars are too low, and it's just not comfortable, then it's not a really practical bike. And can you call a bike like that high performance? You know, I wouldn't. So I don't know.
No, I absolutely agree with you. Comfort does sort of translate into performance, whether it's being able to go long distance or whether it's being able to climb or being able to be, you know, in control when you descend. So I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So who is the person who is buying Rivendell today? Now, Rivendell is your brand. It is still a steel lugged frame for the most part.
Yeah.
And who is your customer?
Well, it's rare that we sell a bike to anybody in his or her 20s. Probably the typical customer is a man or a woman over 40, maybe 40 through late 50s or something, or 60s.
Okay.
And, you know, a lot of them have a history with steel bikes going back a long time, but maybe when they were younger, they couldn't afford a really good one, so they rode Nishikis or something, which are perfectly good. And you know,
they could have ridden Bridgestones, you know.
They could have ridden Bridgestones. But now kids are grown up, houses paid off, you know, they have a little bit of money, and they want to, you know, they can spend $2,200 to $4,800 or something on a bike. So, and they don't, a lot of them have had carbon fiber bikes and have had bikes that are not really suited to their body or the kind of riding that they do. You know, I mean, we've all seen, and I'm sure you've seen, 5'10", 260 pounders on 23 millimeter tires and, you know, some kind of Cervelo or whatever carbon racing bike, and they're dressed in the whole kit, and they're not having fun.
No, they're not.
And so our customers are sort of beyond that. They either leapfrog that whole world or they somehow have survived it, and now they're coming back to something that makes more sense for them.
So one of the things that you do, though, is you have a philosophy of simpler is better. And so do you have any interest in the new electronic stuff, the new shifting? Even the STI kind of stuff.
I guess there are numbers less than zero, so that's how much interest I have in that.
Yeah, they're negative.
Yeah, you know, it's like is an electric can opener, is that a world's better than a good manual can opener? I'm not saying that stick with the hard, crude stuff that you have to grunt out and there's a tough learning curve on it, but electronic shifting, I mean, shifting is so easy anyway, and making it electronic is just, I mean, it seems like it's pandering to this obsession with push-button instant results, whiz-bang stuff. And when you're talking about something as easy as shifting gears, I think that if you – there is some satisfaction to be had or felt in learning to operate a relatively simple mechanism and to have the control over that mechanism in yourself and then a little bit of skill. And if you – in electronic shifting, you are literally pushing buttons and you are abdicating – all of your skill over to the, the skill of the designers and the manufacturers of that electronic. And in some things in life, you know, that may be fine. That is absolutely the way that I want to do it when I'm sitting on the couch muting the commercial during the Big Bang Theory. You know, I don't want to hear that. And I also don't want to get up and go turn down the television myself.
Right,
I'm cool with all that, but when it comes to something that I care about a lot, I mean, I do like the Big Bang Theory, but riding a bicycle, I personally find it easy enough to shift without electronics.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Grant Peterson. I think you're in your office, yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Out at Rivendell Bicycles.
I'm in Dave's office, actually.
Oh, okay.
I don't have an office.
And as we say, Dave's not here. So. Okay. I have kind of a philosophical question, and I don't know if you've thought about it. You think about everything, so I'm sure you have. There are more people riding bikes today than when you and I started in the industry a gazillion years ago.
Yeah.
But do you think anything is going to actually change the whole psyche of the average American to pry him away from his automobile toward other means of transportation, including a bike, but not necessarily just a bike? Do you think things are changing or will change or can change?
I'm a little bit of a pessimist in that way. I think that you know, people go over to Europe and they go to Amsterdam and they come back. And every American who goes over to Amsterdam sends me pictures of bikes, you know.
Yeah, right.
And everyone has the story, why can't we be this way? You know, they have it all down. But, you know, and a similar story is in, you know, there are three-story bicycle parking lots in Japan and great public transportation. But in America, you know, it doesn't work that way. I mean, I wish it did. I'm about as anti-car as somebody who's not, you know, dangerous to society can be. And I don't like to drive them myself. I do have a car, but especially in the West here, I mean, we're out in California, but a lot of places, you know, the cities are designed around cars. And I hear that if you live in Dallas and you ride a bike and you want to go out in someplace nice to ride it, you're going to drive your bike there in a car. And I think, you know, we still have really cheap gas. So I feel like I'm all over the map in answering this question. But I think the thing that gets people out of their cars and onto bikes are disincentives to drive more than incentives to ride. Because I think incentives to ride are kind of weak. I mean, if an incentive to ride is to do good for the earth, well, I mean, I think that is a fine thing, but realistically, you know, one person not driving a car 4 miles and riding a bike 4 miles is not going to make a noticeable difference, a measurable difference. I still think it's a great thing to do, but I don't think that is the kind of motivation that's going to get people out of their cars and onto bikes. I think gasoline would have to be $20 a gallon, and I think that there would have to be good bike parking downtown. A lot of it is urban planning, and urban planning is kind of a dry, boring topic to talk about, and I'm not going to go on for more than 10 seconds on that. But I think if you were to disallow cars to park downtown, make cars park on the outskirts of town and either take a shuttle in or ride their bikes in, I think people would do that. But, of course, merchants aren't going to allow it, so I'm not very optimistic.
Okay.
End of diatribe.
Well, I think there are some places where they're putting in cycle tracks next to roads that some merchants are saying are helping them. So I guess It has to do with the community. It has to do with a lot of things. But I get what you're saying, and I have to agree.
Even in Portland, you know, which is – I mean, Portland and Minneapolis are – they're always duking it out for number one and number two spot.
Right.
And Portland, I think, is now number one. And in Portland, I think 6% of the commuters commute by bicycle. And the average in the country is less than 1%, or maybe it's 1.5% or something like that. So even 6%. And Portland is really accommodating, but 6%, you know, that's not a victory. It's something to applaud, but in the big picture, you know, the car still wins.
Yeah, by 94%, it sounds like.
94%, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about leisure time, because you came up with this idea of it, what an S24O, a sub-24 overnight.
Yeah.
And it's such a cool idea. It's catching on. Adventure cycling is getting into it. Americans don't like to give themselves breaks. They don't even like to take vacation. Explain how your S24O works and how you came up with the idea. I think it's a really cool idea.
Well, yeah. You know, I used to do a lot of climbing the backcountry skiing and just camping out in the mountains and the woods. And then, you know, I started working for a living and got this job and got a married and got a family, and I didn't have time to do that. So I said, oh, I still like to set up a tent and camp out and have a fitful night's sleep. And so I just started going off by myself in the local hills and maybe with a couple friends sometimes. And you know, I've done well over 100 of them now, and it's a good way to get out. You just, they're called sub-24-hour overnights because, I mean, my typical one lasts 16 hours or so. You know, I leave after work, and I am back at work at 9 the next morning, so I leave at, say, 6 o'clock, and I'm back by 9 o'clock the next morning. And you just find some open space, some place where there are no cars, there's no roads, there's no houses. And sometimes, you know, it's legal camping. Sometimes it's stealth camping. I think it's always ethical camping. It's always moral camping. You know, it's not all regular campsites, you know. But so if there's open space, and there is around here, you know, we're quite lucky here. But, you know, all over the country, if you look for it, you know, there's a hill someplace, and there's a place on that hill where you can sort of ride your bike to, and you can set up a little camp there, and no one's going to mess with you. And then you come back the next morning, and that's sort of what it is. So you have kind of a backpacking or bicycle touring experience without the time commitment. So it works out pretty well.
So you just kind of pack your stuff on the back of the bike and take off?
Yeah, you know, the bikes look like bikes packed for touring. I mean, they're usually kind of ragtag with stuff strapped on at the last minute and tied. They aren't neatly packed bikes, but we do a lot of them around here. And I think, yeah, people are doing them all over the world now.
So when you come back from one of your sub-24 overnights, what's different? How do you feel?
I feel tired, like I'm going to sleep well the next night. But it's always great. I've never had a bad one. It's nice out there. You get together, and I go with guys from work and friends outside of work, and you know, we don't whoop it up, you know, we're quiet, but, you know, you get to talk about things, just life in general, that you don't get to talk about at work, you know, that you never have time to. There are no distractions, no one's looking at their cell phones or anything, so you're just sitting around eating and talking, and it is quite delightful.
So you don't necessarily go alone, you do go with other people.
I go with other people.
Nice.
I've gone on a lot of them alone, but I like to go with other people and yak it up.
Yak it up, yuck it up.
Yeah.
I guess. We're speaking with Grant Peterson, who is, you know, just full of such great conversation, as usual. It's nice to talk to you again. It's been a while. So can we talk about your book?
Oh, yeah.
Just Ride is the name of your book?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So according to your website, the book is, quote, a collection of 89 micro essays ranging from 150 to about 850 words, averaging 400 on many familiar and some unfamiliar topics. So the familiar topics are about riding and dressing and safety. What are some of the unfamiliar topics?
Well, I have a section in there that I encourage people to prick their finger with a needle and measure their blood glucose. I guess that's a little bit unfamiliar to most people. Most, you know, diabetics, I'm sure there are plenty of diabetics listening to me right now who wish they didn't have to have their glucose kit there. But glucose kits are cool even for non-diabetics. And so I think that it's good to know what your blood sugars are, because your blood sugar is a some sort of measurement of what's going on inside you and your body's response to carbohydrates and sugar and insulin and all that kind of stuff. And all the diabetics are saying, yeah, 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 but I wish I didn't have to do it. And all the non-diabetics are saying, why do I need to do that? And, you know, the book tells a little bit about that. I mean, that's, I guess it was my book. I got to say anything
exactly
I wanted as long as the publisher allowed it. And,
right.
Yeah, so, you know, that's one of the things. And I talk a little bit about critical mass and charity rides, and I'm not really pro critical mass. I'm not really pro even charity rides about and sponsored rides and stuff like that. So, you know, I stick my neck out there and give. There's probably not anybody in the bike industry who will find everything to agree with. I mean, I get a lot of comments. Yeah, I liked your book. However,
yeah, right.
There's always the but. And I didn't agree with everything, and I don't expect people to do that.
No, you know what? I can't even imagine anybody agreeing with anybody in this industry, or anybody agreeing with everybody in our industry and
right.
What we all say. I mean,
we are
individuals, if
yeah,
nothing else.
So
lastly, I'd like to talk a little bit about Rivendell. And is there anything new on the drawing board? Are there any new products that you're in development right now? Any new models you're coming out with?
Well, you know, I don't know how much this will mean to or interest any listeners, but I'm sort of rethinking in the last year or so my thoughts and opinions just about bicycle geometry and the design of bikes. And I'm sort of in a really long chainstay mode right now, and I don't think I'm ever going to get out of that mode. I think that especially—
Give me a number. When you say long chainstay, are
okay,
we talking 42 centimeters?
No, I'm talking 54, whoa, 55 centimeters.
Are you going to make a cargo bike?
No.
Okay.
But interesting that you should say that, Diane, because riding cargo bikes, you know, you get used to them, and they feel pretty normal when they're unloaded, a little bit long.
Right.
But not, you know, they don't feel really crummy. And, of course, they can carry stuff. So we just sort of split the difference between a normal bike and a cargo bike in chainstay length and came up with, like, 54, 55 centimeters. And a whole lot of good happens there.
Yeah,
know,
like what?
Well, you can have really good tire clearance, really good heel clearance with panniers because the panniers and the tires are really far back. If you go up hills on dirt roads, you absolutely do not ever do a wheelie because the wheel isn't so far underneath you that the front of the bike comes up when you're pulling on the handlebars, because just like you can't do a wheelie on a cargo bike, you can't do one on a bike with a really long chainstay.
Yeah, right. Like you can't do one on a tandem.
Right. You
right.
can't do one on a tandem. It's the same kind of deal there. And, you know, the shorter the wheelbase of the bike, the shorter between the center of the wheel, the more quickly the bike will turn, the tighter a U-turn that you can do. So the bike reacts more to input from the ground or even a gust of wind that you don't see. But if you stretch out the wheelbase, you add a level of sort of beautiful, smooth, control, stability to the bike that you don't have with a bike with a normal wheelbase. So we're talking about 48-inch wheelbases, 4-foot wheelbases, as opposed to 39-inch, 40-inch, 41-inch wheelbases.
Right.
So just by stretching it out another, you know, 6, 7, 8 inches, a lot of good happens. And
are you changing the forks?
Well, no, but with this, we're lengthening the top tubes and then using handlebars that come back really far, too. So you're stretching the bike out in front and in back, and yet you still have a really good upright position. I mean, I would love to get you on one of these bikes sometime. We only have like 10 of them right now, but we have things in development. But I'm telling you, Diane, when you have an upright position with a bar that you can move your hands, you can have like a time trial position on the bar. You can have an upright riding to town position, and you've got nearly 48 inches of wheelbase, and you've got all kinds of hand positions on the handlebars. Some really good things happen, and it's, I don't know.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a techie topic there, but...
No, I like techie topics.
I don't know if anyone else does.
They do. Believe me, they do. Yeah, no, people like to know about this stuff. Well, when do you... So you say you have 10 of them now. What's the name of the bike? Do you have a name for it?
Yeah, it's the Joe Appaloosa. Joe, like a guy's name, Joe,
right.
And then Appaloosa, like the horse.
Nice. How'd you come up with that?
Well, one of our customers, we were looking for a name for the bike, and one of our customers suggested Appaloosa. And I said, that's fine, and I just thought it needs a first name, too. So
Joe.
Joe.
So the J.A. bike. Nice.
J.A. bike.
It's a lug frame, I take it.
Yeah, it's a lug frame.
Okay.
So it has some new kinds of lugs on it, too.
And it'll probably, interesting.
And we had some made... We sold 10 of them as customs or semi-customs where we told people we're going to do this new bike. It'll cost you $4,400, and we aren't going to tell you anything about it, and you don't have any say over anything on the bike, but if you trust me on this that it'll be a neat bike, you can buy one. And we sold 10 in about 4 days. And then about a year and a half later, they got their bikes. But we're going to do it as a production model also, and it'll be around.
Joe Appaloosa.
Joe
I
love Appaloosa.
It. Joe
Appaloosa. Mark that on your calendars, whatever.
Okay. Are you going to be at Interbike this year?
Yeah, I'll go. I don't know whether we'll show. You know, we have only 4 dealers nationwide, so.
You sell mainly direct?
Yeah, mainly direct, because our bikes are too weird for most dealers. You know, it's just. You know.
Have you been in the bike business long? Come on.
I have been in it a long time.
Yes, you have.
Yeah.
Yes, you have. Well, wow, this has really been fun. I haven't talked to you in a long time.
It's been nice, Diane.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling.
Oh, it is my pleasure. So, Grant Peterson, Rivendell Bicycle Works. It's rivbike.com.
Yep.
And there's a bunch of cool stuff out there, and the book is Just Ride. So, Grant, thank you so much. Have a wonderful evening. Go for a ride.
All right, I will.
All right.
Thanks, Diane.
Talk to you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That interview with Grant Peterson was recorded back in 2013. You can see what's happening with Grant and Rivendell at rivbikes.com. So let's take a short break, and then it's back for my 2012 interview with Richard Sachs. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We're back. I'm Diane Jenks, and this is The Outspoken Cyclist. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the following interview with Richard Sachs took place in 2012. I think you'll enjoy it. So let's snuggle in for a chat with one of my frame-building favorites, Richard Sachs. Richie, welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Diane.
Yeah.
Good to hear from you again.
It's nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, likewise.
I want to talk to you about
Your input and your thoughts about the situation with Lance Armstrong, the UCI, all the riders, how you think cycling's going to fare in the long term. Because you have, right from as long as I can remember, been very outspoken about Lance Armstrong and cheating. But do you really believe that Lance is the crux of the problem?
No, he's just the poster boy for it. Well, maybe the crux and the poster boy are the same thing. But, you know, he's in the news. His name in the headline is what sells the papers or what gets people to click on websites and read about the stories. You know, whether they're true or not, you know, that's a secondary concern. But as far as, you know, being the crux of it, yeah, he's the crux of it. He not only allegedly used performance-enhancing drugs, but he owned a team that used them. A lot of the people on the team have kind of come forward in the recent few weeks or months. He had a program in effect, according to his former teammates. And, you know, it's one thing when a guy gets caught out, but it's another thing when it's kind of like a, well, like a secret society, and, you know, all the guys in it are finally, like, rolled out onto the carpet for the rest of us to say, we weren't fooled. Thanks for telling us about it. Or something like that.
So do you ever remember a time when cycling was clean?
Well, I think for your audience, or maybe even for the two of us in this conversation, you might want to define clean. I'll start by saying if it's not on the ban list, then it's fair game. But for the
True.
Average American who's been drawn into the sport since the Lance era, you know, I think the mentality is these guys do what they do on food that we all get at the supermarket, you know, Gatorade, bananas, pasta, protein. Well, let's put it this way. I wouldn't be surprised if all of them didn't use performance-enhancing drugs, you know, whether it's for recovery, strength, conditioning, et cetera. But I don't know if all of them use, you know, the drugs that are on the ban list. And then, you know, as far as the ban list goes, you know, that's a revolving door of pharmaceuticals because some years, you know, you could get caught, you know, testing positive for something that's only going to be on the ban list starting the following season. You know, Pedro Salgado in the late 80s is a good example of that. He was winning the Tour, and he got, you know, busted for probenecid, which I probably am not, you know, pronouncing correctly, but that's a masking agent. But when they realized that it wasn't on the list, it was like, fine. So I think your audience and, you know, the mainstream needs to decide for themselves what the word clean means.
Well, and that's interesting because Greg and I had a conversation about that earlier this evening about it could be cleaner rather than clean. So you're right. You know, you're never going to maybe perhaps have 100% clean. And this week, Taylor Finney also came out with a tweet that says, my guy Cummings, you know, won the race pure, no caffeine. You know, I mean, they're looking at no painkillers, you know, Tylenol, aspirin. And I'm thinking, well, even though those aren't banned substances, are we going, you know, sort of to the other end of the leash? Is the pendulum swinging way in the opposite direction for these young riders?
Well, I heard about that. You know, I don't really pay any attention to stuff like that. You know, that's probably a reaction to the situation that's going on in the last few weeks or months. But, you know, for the record, or at least for the conversation, I don't have any problem with any of these guys taking anything. There are so few of them in the world making a living at what they do that it's almost laughable that anybody would care. What, there's like 300 of them in the world, 400 of them in the world at the most. And we want to be entertained, and we won't be entertained unless these guys do things that we can't do on the weekend. So to that end, I think the sport's always been, quote-unquote, dirty. I think the sport has always had riders who have done as much as they can or as, you know, as whatever they had to beat the other riders that they were racing against. And I accept that. I've never felt differently going back to, like, the 70s when I first was exposed to it. It's just that, as far as I'm concerned, the hypocrisy is when somebody, and this goes back to your original word, at the crux of this, like Lance, has the opportunity to say, well, come on, We're asking everybody to come clean because we're investigating a scandal here. It's not just, you know, a positive test. We're investigating a scandal. And the guy continually lies about it. I have a problem with the lying. I don't have a problem with the cheating because unless you actually get caught, you know, you can't say the guy cheated. But when everything in the public domain is so pointed to, you know, what we have now, you know, I don't like the guy looking in the camera and saying, I'm on my bike 7 hours a day, or are you calling me a doper or a liar, or any of those really awesome sound bites that the guy has had in the last 10 years. It's just insulting to me and to the audience. So that's where I come into this.
I have a question about the responsibility and where it might lie in terms of needing to be faster and stronger and ride longer and harder. Do you think team owners themselves have a responsibility and knew what was going on?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Everybody's involved. And, of course, you know, I can see, like, the lawyers parked outside of my house after a comment like that. But the thing is, the sport's always been dirty, meaning, like I said earlier, that doesn't mean they've taken, you know, banned substances. I just think they try to get away with as much as they can, much like in other sports. But, you know, let's just stay with cycling. I think the distances that they have to ride, the season's duration, the amount of starts that, you know, the riders have to do, the things that the owners want in return for their investment, I think the stakes are pretty high. So I think everybody knows what's going on. It's just that the owners don't want to acknowledge that, you know, they have people on staff that do this. They just hope that they can get away with it. That's a blanket statement I'll make. And I can't imagine anybody comes into the sport of cycling in the late 20th century or in the early 21st century and doesn't know its history. I think what they want is to have the rolling billboards that these guys really are, so that their products can be branded all over the papers and the, you know, the TV coverage, you know, for 10 months, 9 months of a year, and, you know, get their name noticed by, you know, the people that buy their mattresses or the people that buy their, you know, courier services or the people that buy their pharmaceuticals. I mean, at the end of the day, or certainly at the beginning of the day, cycling is as much about advertising as it is about athletics. I mean, we'd have no sport if there were no, like, names on the jerseys.
Well, that's a really interesting point, which took me right to the next question, and that is, don't you think it's truly hypocritical that sponsors turn around and then kind of smack their riders by dropping them when they knew what was going on in the first place?
I got to tell you, Diane, you know, there's this line from The Godfather where Michael Corleone says to Senator Geary something or other, and then it ends with, you know, we're all part of the same hypocrisy, or we're both part of the same hypocrisy.
Right.
All of us, you, me, any fan, any writer, anybody that advertises in a magazine that covers the sport, certainly anybody that drives the team car, all the helpers and the owners and the broadcasters, Phil and Paul, et cetera, all of us know what's going on. Now, I'm sure that there's a small percentage of people that came into the sport because of Lance and the cancer thing that thought, well, this is a great Cinderella story. I am now hooked on cycling, and I'm following the sport because of this man. And I feel bad for those people. You know, I feel good that some people's hopes were elevated because of the story that, you know, we all in the sport and hopefully in the trade knew was smoke and mirrors. But now that this guy's, you know, house of cards has, you know, been blown away, you know, these people that were new to the sport that thought this was real, that they thought this guy did it on training 7 hours a day and, you know, ambition and motivation and training and coaching, I mean, these people, I have no idea. These people have turned into turncoats, too. And I think all of us share the responsibility because we watch a sport, we buy the products, we talk about it, and nobody does anything or says boo as a result. You know, this thing is not the first time we've had a drug story in the sport. I don't remember the sport as not having a drug story, period. But because of being in the States and this being an American-centric story, you know, it's much more there's much more focus on it now than the Festina affair or the G-Wiss. Was it G-Wiss? I forget, with Evgeny Berzin and all those people in the early 90s or whenever it was.
Yeah, I think that's
There's always a story. I mean, none of this surprises anybody who's been in the sport for any kind of time.
That's true. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Richard Sachs, who, as always, is extremely eloquent about this and has such an interesting and spot-on perspective, I think. How do you think cycling might have looked if there had been no doping?
You mean pro racing?
Pro racing. Oh, yeah, no. I mean, I guess we're just talking about the Peloton here, you know, these teams. And it's the, you know, it's the Formula One part of our business.
You know, you've heard me say this many times before, so I'll say it again for your audience. We're the sport. These idiots are just the floor show.
That's true. You do say that. I always forget that.
They're the entertainment. You know, when they get knocked over, there's more entertainment in the wings ready to entertain us. We turn on the television because we're conditioned to it, and we follow the Velo News on the cyclingnews.com because we're racing cyclists, or we're cyclists who have followed the sport for a number of years. And, you know, my perspective is their entertainment. You know, sure, they're doing something athletic, but they're there to entertain me. For the sponsors, they're there to sell whatever name or brand is on their back, period. So it's almost as though the race results themselves are secondary or tertiary or not even important. But as long as these guys get photographed, then, you know, the brands get free advertising on the front page of the sports section. They get 7 hours of exposure on the television when there's a feed, etc. If they didn't take anything, I guess the Tour de France would end in September because it would probably take that long to be using cream of wheat and bananas and Gatorade to recover and, you know, start again the next morning. You know, I make light of it, but the truth is, you know, it'll never be clean. There's way too much, you know, you didn't ask the question. I'm just going to tell you this right now because I've said it a lot lately. I think the tour or the grand tours, you know, for your audience that doesn't follow the sport, you know, there's three or so grand tours. The Tour de France is the most notorious one. I think that business model has long since, you know, passed its sell-by date. You know, the tours, especially the Tour de France, was conceived to sell newspapers back in the early 1900s or the late 1800s. I don't know because I don't.
It was a long time ago.
That's before my time. But, you know, I can understand in those eras that they wanted to find ways to, you know, create or, you know, exploit a brand, which was, you know, the newspaper that, you know, sponsored the event. But it's turned into a freaking three-ring circus. There's a certain breed of cat that doesn't even know that bike racing occurs from February to October. They think that bike racing and the Tour de France are one and the same.
Right.
But a true connoisseur or a true cycling buff or a racing buff, you know, thinks as much or more than of the classics and the, you know, the worlds and the other disciplines as the average Joe armchair, you know, with his remote control probably thinks of the Tour. You know, the rest of us follow the sport, such as it is, and some people who are latecomers follow the Tour. And when the Tour is over, they wouldn't even know that these guys are still racing two days later or 2 weeks later. I think, you know, I'm probably in the small minority, but I think the Tour has to go. I think, and it's not going to go because nobody's going to, like, care what I think, but, you know, it's just not relevant, you know?
What else might take its place? How important is it to cycling? How is this racing important to cycling? What else might take its place to keep it as exciting and interesting?
You know, it's hard to answer your question because, first of all, you know, I think the first thing that should happen is all the users on the positive tests and everybody who, you know, said that they once were part of it should be shown the door and thrown out of cycling, period. No six-month suspension, no second chances, just get them out. You know, everybody that's been testifying lately, and today it was Bobby Julich, everybody says, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it, I was sucked into it. Great. See ya. I mean, on one hand, we need to do that. We need to clean all of these guys out of the sport and then see what's left. If anybody's still left, you know, they should agree, you know, to say that they don't have a story. And if they get caught, you know, with a backdated story, they get thrown out too. But personally, if there was no bike racing on television, I'd be out riding my bike, or I'd be in the shop, or, you know, walking across the field with Deb and Buddy or whatever. That's what people should do. These guys, there's a whole world of things to do besides watch these idiots, you know, try to go up a mountain. You know, they have like eight guys leading a leader to the base of the mountain, which is like 99% of the race, and then the leader gets launched, and he goes up the top, and he's called the winner. You know, I don't get that. I never got that. You know, I've been watching these races for four decades, and this stuff is just, it's, I watch it because it's there, and if it ended tomorrow, I wouldn't miss it at all. I don't think that I don't think cycling needs pro racing as much as other people might think it does, but you're talking to me, so that's kind of where I stand on it.
Well, and I appreciate that. I appreciate it a lot, and I wanted your opinion. And unfortunately, we're beginning to run out of time for this time, and you know I'm going to invite you back again because I love having you on the show. But Greg, I think, has a question. Greg.
What I want to know is how you reconcile or bring together the two viewpoints that you sort of expressed at the beginning and the end of this conversation. First, you said you didn't have a problem with cheating, and then just recently you said anybody who's cheated should be thrown out. So bring those two together for me because I'm confused.
Well, no problem. You see, in my opinion, or according to my opinion, cycling was much better before it got quote-unquote Americanized, before the Lance thing, before Postal showed up, before Weisel and all the Americans with their corporate jets and their, you know, boardroom tactics went to Europe and tried to appropriate the sport as its own. I think the sport is an old man's sport. I think it's a pre-war sport. It's a pre-television sport. It's not unlike boxing. It's a little bit like, you know, Rollerball, the movie or the book. To a certain extent, it's unbelievable, like, you know, wrestling is. And, you know, when I was a kid, I got into it. But it never occurred to me that what they were doing was real. It never bothered me. So when people talk about Omerta or the way things used to be, I accept that the entertainment I get in return for watching or, you know, everything else, if there's something wrong with it and they're cheating, I don't care. But if you get caught, you just take your time out, you shut up, and then you come back. That's the way it always was. Sport kind of runs itself. Ever since the sport got Americanized, ever since it became like a big business here in the States with Lance and the tour and the broadcast and all the people that follow it, I kind of feel like, okay, it's the same, but if you go up to the microphone and say, I don't cheat, I pass 500 tests, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, hey, I don't care what you do, but don't go afterwards and say your successes were done without the cheating or without the, you know, the PEDs, because it's insulting. So, you know, on one hand, I don't want to know because I already do know. It's not possible to do this stuff clean, because it would take forever to finish most of the races. Does that help you?
So it's basically the institutional blind eye that keeps getting turned to all of this.
Yeah.
In favor of you know, trying to promote a sport that is allegedly clean, but everybody knows it's not.
It'll never be clean. It never was clean. What we have now is just what we have now. It'll go away, and we'll have another episode in a year, in a few years, and we'll look back at this as like our generation's Festina affair.
Interesting.
But I accept it, and I just, you know, I'll keep watching it as long as it's there, mainly because, you know, it's kind of fun, and I also feel that the entertainment value that I get from pro cycling comes as much from the backstory and these issues making the news and, you know, the personalities getting rolled out into the carpet and we find out what these people are really made of. I find that as entertaining or more entertaining than the sport itself. And to me, it's like one big stew and inseparable.
Well, Richard, either you and I are two of the smartest guys on the planet because we both have kind of the same viewpoint on this, or we're two complete nutballs. One of the two.
Wait a minute. Do they have to be mutually exclusive? All right, Richard. Well, it's, as always, wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much for...
Well, thanks for calling, and you guys have a nice afternoon. Okay?
All right. Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
Okay.
Richard Sachs joined us from...
The East Coast. He's in New England somewhere.
He's up in New England
somewhere. Yeah, I can never remember where he lives.
One of them states up there.
One of them their states.
There's a famous quote by a British gentleman. I couldn't find the exact attribution.
Yeah.
It says, if you believe those boys ride up mountains on salads and fizzy water, you're quite mistaken.
Yes.
I think that kind of summarized what Richard was saying.
That pretty much says it all. You got it.
All right.
Okay.
Well, always great to talk to Richard Sachs.
It was. And boy, he has such... interesting insight.
And a great way of presenting them, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's our show for this week. Thanks so much for listening. And since so many of you chimed in with requests for specific guests, I'll start working on that list. There will be a new show next week, and it will be pre-recorded because Brian and I will be at the Horsey 100 in Kentucky. If you see us riding our Bushnell tandem, wave and say hello. In the meantime, I hope you have a wonderful week. Stay safe out there, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.